The Tom Woods Show, episode 1908.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, folks, if you've been meaning to get into Bitcoin, but you don't know what you're doing and you feel like you're never going to do it, I have the solution for you. It's Coinbit's app. It rounds up your purchases and takes the spare change and automatically invests it in Bitcoin for you. And before you know it, you have a nice little portfolio. Turn it on and off whenever you want. Grab your money whenever you want. Check it out at coinbitsapp.com/woods. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. All right, now today we're going to get into the details that I have not covered very much in the nearly 2,000 episodes of the Tom Woods Show, maybe a little bit here and there. But what I want to do today is address specifically the claim that deregulation is what caused the financial crisis of 2008. And I want to go into the specifics of what that claim amounts to. Now, most people who make this claim honestly have no idea what they're talking about. If you were to say to them, name me a repealed regulation that would have prevented this crisis, they have absolutely no idea what to say. The more advanced ones might say something about the repeal of Glass-Steagall, quote unquote. And what they mean to say is the partial repeal of Glass-Steagall, and we'll talk about that. But in general, most people don't even know an answer. And if they do have an answer, you know, their knowledge is, sometimes people say a mile wide and an inch deep. This is like an inch wide and an inch deep. If you were to follow up with them, they really have nothing to say. So I want to arm you with the ammunition you would need in case you find yourself in this discussion, but also just to make clear how misleading, to put it mildly, the conventional wisdom about this is. And it goes to show why it's so important to smash this kind of conventional wisdom before it ossifies. In yesterday's episode, number 1907, I set the stage a bit by describing the ways in which the federal government and the Federal Reserve stimulated housing artificially and the problems that resulted from that. And so now we're going to go on to this other dimension of the question. But I want to just say that it's naive and uncomprehending to think that once the Federal Reserve has set an artificial boom in motion, that there's some kind of phantom regulation that can reel it back in. At that point, the horse has left the stable. It's a little bit ridiculous once you've allowed the Federal Reserve. If you don't want a financial bubble, then get rid of the Federal Reserve. Get rid of the credit spigot that allows these bubbles to be blown up and to persist. But don't let that happen. Don't let the Fed engage in crazy money creation and then ignore that and sit back and say, if only we'd had more regulation. That's so beside the point. One of the best forms of so-called regulation from a free market standpoint is to let failing businesses fail when they need to fail. And so what I want to start with is the claim that, well, we can't do that because some institutions are too big to fail. So we can't let them fail because then there'll be a cascading of failures throughout the economy. We don't want that. So we can't actually discipline firms by allowing them to go out of business, even though that is the market's form of discipline. And you better believe that would get some of these actors to shape up and do the right thing and make sound financial decisions. Well, we can't do that, they say, because some of these institutions are too big to fail. So General Motors was too big to fail. Bear Stearns was too big to fail. AIG. And the widespread acceptance of the too big to fail theory helps to account for why only weeks after Bear Stearns failed, Lehman Brothers, which held the same kind of assets that Bear Stearns had held, was still able to raise hundreds of millions of dollars. How was it able to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, even though it appeared to be in exactly the same straits that Bear Stearns, which had just failed, had been in? And it's because most people looking at the situation felt like it was fairly probable that Lehman would be bailed out by the government. In fact, even a major money market fund, Reserve Primary, got a piece of the action. And a fund like that is supposed to make only the most conservative investments. So Lehman looked like a conservative investment to some people because of the history, the very, very, very recent history of government bailouts. Now, think of what the implications of this are, whether it's a financial institution or something like General Motors. Any firm that is widely considered to be so-called too big to fail enjoys artificial advantages at the expense of its competitors, because lenders know these firms enjoy government protection, at least implicitly. So therefore, lenders consider their investments in these firms to be basically without risk. And so the net result is that these firms that are said to be too big to fail can attract capital artificially easily. And smaller firms are put at a competitive disadvantage as a result. And so when the next crisis comes, the too big to fail firms will be all the larger. And warnings of systemic risk, if we allow the too big to fail firm to fail, that'll become all the more hysterical. And then you get another cycle of bailouts. So we learned in 2009 that in the wake of the bailouts, the largest banks were able to borrow from the Fed at considerably lower rates than smaller ones. And that gave them a competitive advantage, the larger firms. They see, this is the kind of thing that most progressives miss. It's like they're not even trying to look for it, because most progressives, in my experience, don't know anything about the Federal Reserve. They think it's weirdly conspiratorial even to talk about it. So when there are ways in which the Fed or government regulation tend to privilege larger institutions at the expense of smaller ones, then they go ahead and blame capitalism for why they think certain outcomes are lopsided. And they don't look at the systematic reason for why these things might be lopsided. So, for example, the Wall Street Journal wrote this: the handful of banks with more than $10 billion in assets were paying 1.18% to borrow money in the second quarter, the FDIC in data issued Thursday. By contrast, banks with between $100 million and $1 billion in assets were paying 1.97%, a big difference in a business where tenths of a percentage point translate into millions of dollars in profits, unquote. And some of these incentives that the whole too big to fail doctrine gives rise to are not particularly subtle. So I want to read you a passage from an economist named Craig Pirong, and he writes this: Goldman Sachs knows it is too big to fail. How does it know this? Well, the government bailed out AIG, not so much for AIG's sake, but for the sake of big AIG counterparties, most notably Goldman. Moreover, given the conventional wisdom that the government's primary error in the financial crisis was its failure to bail out Lehman, a piker compared to Goldman, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that it won't repeat that mistake in the future and let Goldman go down. So Goldman knows it can get bigger and take more risk. It is the classic heads Goldman wins, tails the sucker taxpayer eats the loss gambit. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac surely knew they were too big to fail. Freddie Mac's David Andrukonis writes, the thinking was that if something really bad happened to the housing market, then the government would need Freddie and Fannie more than ever and would have to rescue them. And then a top Freddie Mac executive added this, quote, it basically worked exactly as everyone expected. When things got bad, the government came to the rescue, unquote. So the most fundamental reasons to allow companies to fail include the following. So first one, without market discipline, large firms will adopt artificially risky and often heavily debt-based strategies, knowing full well that any downside risk will just be shared with the public. Then another one, instead of promptly discontinuing wealth-destroying activities, which is frankly what these firms are up to, we're keeping them alive. Then another one, genuinely profitable wealth-generating activities are deprived of investment capital and other resources because those things are being diverted to ongoing wealth destruction by giving them to bailed-out firms. Firms that are obviously destroying wealth, that's why they're going out of business. Then the mechanism by which the market puts resources into the hands of the most skilled and deserving is undermined. That's what the profit and loss system does relentlessly, day after day after day, is to move resources away from people incapable of being good stewards of them and into the hands of people with proven track records. Then, firms that are marginally below the magical too big to fail threshold now have an incentive to take still greater risks because they're so close to that promised land of government protection, they might as well get considerably riskier, hoping they can get over that threshold. Then, allowing large firms to fail would encourage other market participants to move toward savings-based rather than debt-based finance models, which would be maybe a healthy shift. Now, let's take the specific case of Bear Stearns. The official rationale for bailing out Bear Stearns was that the company was too interconnected to be allowed to fail because its failure would have triggered a cascade of other failures, ending in general catastrophe. Now, one of the problems with that story is that the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which held an investigation about all this, found that Bear's assets exceeded its liabilities, so which meant it was legally solvent at the end of its first fiscal quarter of 2008. Now, maybe this estimate was mistaken, but Bear was obviously not worthless or just a shell, and creditors would have been made more or less whole in bankruptcy proceedings. Bankruptcy, regardless of what we feel about it, was designed for a situation like this because the ailing firm gets some breathing room, it can assess its situation, it can amass what resources it can, and arrange for the orderly satisfaction of creditor claims. Now, when Lehman Brothers failed just 6 months later, the situation was different. Lehman was likely both illiquid and insolvent, and it was allowed to go under. But the alleged cascade of failures never materialized. And here's Peter Wallison from the American Enterprise Institute. I've had him on the show several times. And he says this, even Lehman's credit default swap obligations, credit default swap, CDS, and the CDSs written specifically on Lehman by others did not cause any substantial disruption in the CDS market when Lehman collapsed. Within a month after the bankruptcy, all of the CDSs specifically written on Lehman were settled through the exchange of approximately $6 billion among hundreds of counterparties, and while Lehman had over 900,000 derivatives contracts outstanding at the time it filed for bankruptcy, these did not give rise to any known insolvency among those of its counterparties that were protected by a Lehman CDS. In cases where Lehman's derivatives counterparties suffered losses, the counterparties filed appropriate claims in the Lehman bankruptcy proceeding, which are being adjudicated in the ordinary course. In other words, Lehman, a larger firm than Bear and one that had more interconnections, had no significant effect in dragging down its counterparties. If Lehman's interconnections did not drag down its counterparties, Bear's certainly would not have done so. Now, the shock that hit the markets when Lehman collapsed was due less to Lehman's collapse per se than to the fact that it seemed to suggest that the government was behaving in a very ad hoc way in its approach to the crisis. So Stanford's John Taylor was convinced that it was not so much the Lehman collapse that spooked the markets. It was the public's realization that the government has obviously not thought through its intervention plan. And he says, quote, this was likely amplified by the ad hoc decisions to support some financial institutions and not others, and unclear, seemingly fear-based explanations of programs to address the crisis. What was the rationale for intervening with Bear Stearns, then not with Lehman, and then again with AIG? What would guide the operations of the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and so on? What in fact happens during a financial crisis is not that one bankruptcy leads to another and so on down a road to general catastrophe. The string of failures we observe in a crisis like this is not caused by interconnectedness among the firms involved, but rather by a common exposure they all share. So in the case of 2008, the firms we're talking about were all exposed to a mortgage market that had begun to collapse. Financial firms, as a rule, diversify their assets precisely in order not to expose themselves unduly to the fortunes of any one institution. In Lehman's bankruptcy filing, the largest creditor turned out to be a Tokyo-based bank that was owed $463 million. But their capital base was $7.4 billion, so this was not about to threaten their solvency. So what happened during the financial crisis was that these mortgage-backed securities that we talked about in the previous episode that were held by these large firms fell very dramatically in value, and that threatened the solvency of these institutions. It turns out that the assets they were holding had been wildly overvalued. But bear in mind that recognizing the true values of these previously mispriced assets, even if that means their prices fall dramatically, doesn't change the amount of physical stuff in the economy. It's true that a fall in asset values could very well lead to the bankruptcy of institutions that were heavily invested in them. But that would mean only that the distribution of that unchanged amount of wealth would shift from one group of people to another. Bankruptcy courts would establish new ownership titles, and economic activity could then resume on a new and sounder foundation. Hey, folks, let's take a minute to thank probably one of the cleverest sponsors I've had, and that is Coinbit's app. I know a lot of you folks have been thinking, yeah, maybe I should get into Bitcoin, and maybe there's a dip, and now's the time to buy, but is now the time, and I don't really know what I'm doing, and I don't really want to shell out that much dough all at once, and so then you wind up not doing anything. But here's an easy way to do something that maybe you already want to do. Coinbit's app is a Bitcoin investing app that rounds up your everyday spare change and automatically invests it in Bitcoin for you. So for example, you buy a cup of coffee for $2.75, Coinbit's will round up to $3, take that extra 25 cents, and buy Bitcoin with it. So you set it, forget it, and start building up your Bitcoin holdings. It's done easily, painlessly, and anytime you want to stop doing it, just click a button and it's off and done. And you can withdraw your money anytime you want. So forget about deciding when to buy, how much, what platform to use. Coinbit's takes all that away by automatically investing your spare change for you weekly. And you'd be surprised at how quickly that adds up. So check it out over at coinbitsapp.com/woods. That's coinbitsapp.com/woods. So now let's get into the deregulation claim. Barack Obama, when he was running for president, identified deregulation as the source of the crisis. Now, since taking office, he more or less abandoned that line of argument. But people still continue to believe it, even though very few people, as I said, can actually give you specific examples of relevant deregulation. So, I mean, for some people, it's like this argument is so natural, they don't even need to do any research. They just know that deregulation must have caused our problems, even if they have no idea what deregulation is or what it consisted of or what exactly our problems are. So I don't know how many Americans think that there's no problem too great that their wise overlords couldn't have prevented it by just being able to crack a few more skulls. So the possibility that the people protecting us may themselves be the source of the problem is just unthinkable. And of course, we've seen that amply demonstrated in the COVID fiasco. So let's look at the key planks of financial regulation over the past several decades, and you'll see that there isn't a whole lot here that could account for the severity of the crisis that struck in 2008. So it was under Jimmy Carter that Regulation Q was mostly repealed, and that limited the amount of interest that banks could pay on savings deposits. Well, it doesn't seem like that would have caused a global financial meltdown 30 years later. Then the Regal-Neal Interstate Banking and Branching Efficiency Act of 1994 repealed restrictions on interstate branch banking. Well, that doesn't seem like that would destabilize the banking system because presumably if you allow interstate branch banking, it allows banks to diversify their portfolios more easily. And then finally, bank holding companies were allowed to underwrite corporate securities. Now, that in itself is not particularly risky. Charles Calamiris, a professor at Columbia Business School, I've also had him on the show, is correct to note that we'd be in much better shape today if these institutions had been doing more corporate underwriting, similar to insurance, and less securitizing of bad mortgages. There's nothing relevant that the banks did in the years leading up to the crisis that they couldn't have done in the absence of deregulation. Banks have always been free to hold or securitize mortgages, including the subprime and no-doc varieties of mortgages. There is no repealed regulation that would have prevented them from doing these things. Now, the one specific act of deregulation that sometimes is pointed to as a contributor to the crisis is what I referred to earlier, the partial repeal of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act by means of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999. Now, once people realized that Joe Biden had supported this in the Senate and Bill Clinton had signed it into law, well, some people backed away from that because it would embarrass their political heroes. So what is this Glass-Steagall that we hear so much about? The Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 consisted of four basic provisions whose combined effect was to erect a wall between commercial banking that you and I use and investment banking. So first, it prohibited banks from underwriting or dealing in securities, apart from essentially riskless government-issued or government-backed securities. The prohibition on dealing in securities meant that banks could not acquire securities for the purpose of selling them, but they could acquire them to hold because they believed them to be good investments. Banks could later sell them when they concluded they were no longer good investments, or just when they happened to need cash. Then second, securities firms could not take deposits. And then the remaining two provisions prevented banks even from being affiliated with firms whose main function was to underwrite or deal in securities. Well, Graham Leach Bliley repealed only this last part of the earlier legislation, and it thereby made it possible for a commercial bank and an investment bank to coexist under the umbrella of a common holding company. It did not repeal the provision preventing banks from underwriting or dealing in securities. Commercial banks continue to operate under the same Glass-Steagall restrictions that have existed since 1933. The financial condition of the banks and the financial crisis itself had nothing to do with the repeal of Glass-Steagall. The problem occurred because banks made bad loans and investments. So in other words, banks did a bad job at traditional banking activities, not some newfangled activity that deregulation had made possible. Many commercial banks held large portfolios of mortgage-backed securities, but it wasn't some repeal of Glass-Steagall that allowed them to accumulate those portfolios. They were always allowed to do that. But did the repeal of two provisions of Glass-Steagall, allowing affiliation of commercial banks with securities firms through their control by the same holding company, contribute to the losses and risk that permeated the system? Well, certainly not. For one thing, commercial banks bought mortgage-backed securities for their AAA rating, which meant that they were of high quality. So for their AAA rating, their attractive return, and the minimal capital requirements associated with holding them. They did not acquire these assets because they were connected to investment banks that were trying to unload them. Also, severe regulatory firewalls essentially prevent this kind of affiliation from contributing to losses or increased risk on the part of the commercial bank involved. The reverse problem, that affiliation with a commercial bank might bring down an investment bank, is exceedingly unlikely given the relative magnitudes of assets held by each institution. Commercial banks' assets were only a tiny fraction of those held by the investment banks they were affiliated with. These banks were in no position to cause the investment banks any serious problem, much less their complete downfall. Even the Washington Post pointed out the irrelevance of the partial repeal of Glass-Steagall. So, for example, they write this: Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch, three institutions at the heart of the crisis, were pure investment banks that had never crossed the old line into commercial banking. The same goes for Goldman Sachs, the infamous AIG, an insurance firm, New Century Financial, a real estate investment trust. No Glass-Steagall there. Two of the biggest banks that went under, Wachovia and Washington Mutual, got into trouble the old-fashioned way, largely by making risky loans to homeowners. Bank of America nearly met the same fate, not because it had bought an investment bank, but because it had bought Countrywide Financial, a vanilla variety mortgage lender. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo, two large banks with big investment banking arms, resisted taking government capital and arguably could have weathered the crisis without it. So what deregulation can critics have in mind? Alan Meltzer of Carnegie Mellon says, "I would challenge anybody to point to something important that was deregulated during the last 8 years. The last major financial deregulation was the 1999 act that President Clinton signed, removing the Glass-Steagall provisions separating commercial and investment banking. No other country in the world separates commercial and investment banking, and none of them have problems on that account. Nor have we had problems on that account." Then economist Bill Woolsey says this: "Glass-Steagall is a red herring. I think it's brought up because it's the only bit of deregulation that seems slightly relevant. And some people cannot accept that misregulation and entrepreneurial error, rather than deregulation, was the key source of the problem." In fact, during the boom years, the Federal Reserve boasted of its unique ability to foresee and prevent financial crises. And let's remember that the Fed is considered to be the key regulator of the banking system. And they said, well, don't worry, we've got this in hand, we can do this. Here's January 2007, Ben Bernanke, who was at that time chairman of the Federal Reserve, this is on the verge of the financial crisis, telling a gathering of academics. So this is a passage from Bernanke. Together with the knowledge obtained through its monetary policy and payments activities, information gained through its supervisory activities gives the Fed an exceptionally broad and deep understanding of developments in financial markets and financial institutions. In my view, however, the greatest external benefits of the Fed's supervisory activities are those related to the institution's role in preventing and managing financial crises. In other words, the Fed can prevent most crises and manage the ones that do occur. Finally, the wide scope of the Fed's activities in financial markets, including not only bank supervision and its roles in the payments system, but also the interaction with primary dealers and the monitoring of capital markets associated with the making of monetary policy, has given the Fed a uniquely broad expertise in evaluating and responding to emerging financial strains. Well, that was Ben Bernanke. And then later that year, the housing bubble burst. So, of course, the Fed failed to prevent the 2008 crisis and itself bears much responsibility for what went wrong. Now, did that make the political class re-examine the Fed's claims about its wondrous abilities? Now, of course, to the contrary, in the wake of the crisis, the Fed was given still more regulatory authority. So it seems to be a general rule. And again, the COVID situation only amplifies this. No matter how badly regulators fail, every crisis brings calls to empower them further. There seems to be nothing that regulators could do to make the public consider the excluded possibility that mere regulation of a flawed system doesn't make the system at root any less flawed. Our talking heads who thoughtlessly call for more regulation as a panacea are attributing quasi-magical powers to people who, in the real world, tend to be unworthy of these exaggerations. As Bob Higgs put it, had they been given even greater powers, budgets, and staffs, what enchantment would have transformed the regulators into smart, dogged champions of the public interest, rather than the time-serving drones and co-conspirators with the regulated firms that they have always been? Think of the case of Bernie Madoff. Madoff ran a scheme in which wealthy, if gullible, individual and institutional investors wound up losing $50 billion. Madoff was extraordinarily skilled at beating the market, is what his clients thought. In fact, all he was doing was taking later clients' money and using it to pay earlier clients. And obviously that scheme requires the addition of a greater and greater number of new clients over time. That's a Ponzi scheme. So what was the immediate predictable result? The Madoff fiasco shows what happens when you cut funding and personnel for the Securities and Exchange Commission, which critics said suffered under George W. Bush. Additional regulators and more funding would solve the problem. But actually, George W. Bush hadn't cut funding or personnel for anything at all. SEC funding increased at an 11.3% annualized rate, as compared to 6.8% under Bill Clinton. Its staff grew at 1% per year, as compared with negative 1.2% under Jimmy Carter. So we have to entertain another theory. Maybe for all its employees and wealth, the government had simply failed. The SEC had been warned about Madoff for at least 10 years, and perhaps as many as 16. Madoff even boasted of his family ties at the SEC. So even though it had the largest budget and largest staff in its history, it still failed to act. By contrast, Harry Markopoulos, one of Madoff's competitors, simply examined the options strategy Madoff told his clients he was using and concluded that his alleged results had to be fraudulent. So you see how an alert competitor has a powerful incentive to be a good regulator himself? All right, so maybe it took them at least a decade of warnings, but at least the SEC finally wised up and did the right thing and nabbed him, right? Actually, the SEC had nothing to do with it. Madoff's own sons turned him in after he came to them and explained what he had done. And he felt compelled to approach them with the real story in the first place, only because his financial situation had begun to deteriorate so badly. catching him had nothing to do with the SEC at all. The very existence of the SEC lowers the natural alertness investors would otherwise have. So they think to themselves, if such and such investment outlet were in fact a criminal Ponzi scheme, well, the SEC would have done something about it. Now, a private certification agency that made an error of this magnitude would be finished, never to be heard from again. Would you continue to rely on it? Meanwhile, other institutions would quickly gain market share at the incompetent firm's expense. The SEC, on the other hand, is going to get more money. As it turns out, spending and personnel have increased dramatically, not just on the SEC, but throughout the whole arena of financial regulation. The 12,190 people in Washington, D.C. alone, who are charged with overseeing American financial markets, would probably have something to say about the allegedly unregulated American financial system. Adjusted for inflation, spending on the regulatory agencies in charge has tripled since alleged deregulation began in 1980. I've given that statistic numerous times, and the best the other side can come up with is to say that that's not adjusted for inflation. And then I point out that it is, and then they don't know what to say. Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University came up with a tally of 115 regulatory agencies for financial services. So we're supposed to believe that things would improve if only we had had 116? And incidentally, just because you have more regulators doesn't mean you're going to get more genuine oversight. George Stigler is a Nobel laureate in economics, and he developed a capture theory of regulation whereby firms in a regulated industry tend to capture the regulatory body so that they and their concerns dominate the regulatory agenda. And that agenda becomes an instrument of the further aggrandizement rather than the genuine supervision of the industry. So if that's correct, then we have here another reason to consider it naive, simplistic, childish, to foist major tasks of economic stabilization onto regulatory bodies in some superstitious hope that this race of supermen will identify and act upon problems before anyone else perceives them, and always with an eye to the public interest. Not to mention the revolving door that often exists between regulatory agencies and the private sector. A Wall Street Journal headline ran, SEC lawyer one day, opponent the next. Gerald O'Driscoll, who was a former vice president of the Dallas Fed, said, "The idea that multiplying rules and statutes can protect consumers and investors is surely one of the great intellectual failures of the 20th century. Any static rule will be circumvented or manipulated to evade its application." Now remember, the regulators themselves failed to predict the crisis or even to identify the problems in the economy leading to the crisis. We were told and said that things were fine, the economy is robust. Alan Greenspan in 2005 said conditions in the housing market were actually encouraging, his word. Ben Bernanke, who succeeded Greenspan as Fed chairman, said that, quote, "Our examiners tell us that lending standards are generally sound and are not comparable to the standards that contributed to broad problems in the banking industry two decades ago. In particular, real estate appraisal practices have improved," unquote. And then he said that a slower growth in house prices may be possible, but he would just lower interest rates if that were to occur. But now let's suppose regulators had been able to perceive the problem. Would they know how to fix it? Would they have the courage to try? Russ Roberts says, "A regulatory crackdown on loose mortgage underwriting standards in 2004 would have meant taking away a punch bowl filled with more home ownership, particularly among minorities, as well as expansion and profits in the businesses of home building, real estate brokerage, mortgage origination, and Wall Street financial engineering." So you think some time-serving drone in a regulatory agency is going to stand up against that? Not too bloody likely. And let's be blunt here. How many business school or other graduate students aspire to become regulators? The brighter students go on to become successful businessmen and entrepreneurs. The slower ones wind up in the regulatory agencies. We expect a kid who graduated number 505 out of a class of 508 not to get his clock cleaned by a kid who graduated number 12. Now, in this episode, I won't talk about Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill that was passed in 2010, but I will link on the show notes page to an episode I did about that with somebody who wrote a whole book on it. But let's make a couple more points here. The capital requirements that banks operated under rewarded them for holding mortgage-backed securities because they were allowed to hold fewer reserves against them, and that freed up money to make even more loans. So for every $100 it held in standard loans, a bank needed $10 in capital. For every $100 in mortgage loans, the amount was $5. And for every $100 of AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities they held, banks were required to have only $2 in capital. So that naturally encouraged an artificial rush into this particular kind of asset. Now, on a free market, institutions are probably likely to hold a wide variety of assets. But when government regulation artificially fosters one kind of asset over another, as it did in this case, the favored asset will be more widely held than it would otherwise have been. And if it declines in value, the economic effects will be that much more severe. Economists Jeffrey Friedman and Vladimir Krauss said that regulations are like mandatory instructions for herd behavior, automatically increasing systemic risk. Now, we hear a lot of hand-wringing about poor management at major financial institutions. But what we don't hear so much about is that the current regulatory environment makes it essentially impossible for professional and institutional investors to do anything about it. So institutions like insurance companies, pension funds, mutual funds, and banks are not permitted to hold more than a very small stake in any particular company. Hedge funds and private equity investors are restricted by regulations that prevent them from acquiring a controlling interest in a bank holding company. But it's these kinds of institutional investors who have a direct stake in the firms in question that are best positioned to keep wayward management in line. So just hoping that regulators will perceive these problems when they have none of their own money at stake, and when, as in the present crisis, they have a track record of identifying problems as virtues, is not very promising. And so because of this government policy, stockholders of these institutions are artificially disorganized and scattered and cannot discipline bank management properly. And management, meanwhile, enjoys an artificial protection that would not exist on the free market. And so when bank managers feather their nests under a system like this, our commentators then react with surprise. Then we also hear investment bank leverage was too high. So in other words, these institutions were looking to multiply their gains by using money borrowed at low interest rates to purchase long-term assets they expected to increase in value. Now, these institutions may well have engaged in too much of this, but we should pause to consider why they might have done so. Why would equity ratios be so low in the financial industry and so much higher everywhere else? Could it be that the financial industry, unlike, say, the shellfish industry or the publishing industry, has a giant sugar daddy in the form of the Federal Reserve standing in the wings to provide liquidity at critical moments, with the federal government on too big to fail ground standing ready to assist them in case of an especially serious problem? When Alan Greenspan made sure the long-term capital management hedge fund was bailed out in 1998, Wall Street firms naturally concluded that if a hedge fund wasn't allowed to fail, then surely no investment bank would be permitted to go under. And even the International Monetary Fund admitted in 2008 that big financial institutions were taking excessive risks in the expectation that their central bank would bail them out. They have grown, quote, more complacent about their liquidity risk management systems and underinsured against an adverse liquidity event, depending more heavily on central bank intervention for their liquidity problems, unquote. It's the system itself, in other words, that's the problem. Here's what Guido Holzmann, who's also been a guest on the old Tom Woods show, biographer of Ludwig von Mises, has to say. This is a lengthy passage, but worth it. He says, the banks must keep certain minimum amounts of equity and reserves. They must observe a great number of rules in granting credit. Their executives must have certain qualifications, and so on. Yet these stipulations trim the branches without attacking the root. They seek to curb certain known excesses that spring from moral hazard, but they do not eradicate moral hazard itself. As we have seen, moral hazard, and by the way, moral hazard refers to the artificially high risk tolerance you have when you know that somebody else will pay for the losses. It's like when you rent a car, you don't go get a rental car washed. You don't get an oil change for a rental car. You're not going to have that car for the long term. You figure somebody else will take care of that. Now back to Guido Holzman. As we've seen, moral hazard is implied in the very existence of paper money. Because a paper money producer can bail out virtually anybody, the citizens become reckless in their speculations. They count on him to bail them out, especially when many other people do the same thing. To fight such behavior effectively, one must abolish paper money. Regulations merely drive the reckless behavior into new channels. And continuing with Holzman, one might advocate the pragmatic stance of fighting moral hazard on an ad hoc basis wherever it shows up. Thus, one would regulate one industry after another until the entire economy is caught up in a web of micro-regulations. This would, of course, provide some sort of order, but it would be the order of a cemetery. Nobody could make any potentially reckless investment decisions anymore. Everything would have to follow rules set up by the legislature. In short, the only way to fight moral hazard without destroying its source, fiat inflation, is to subject the economy to a Soviet-style central plan. Now back to me. If we want to understand where banking instability comes from, we might start where Guido recommends. Instead of fooling ourselves into believing that another round of regulations will keep things stable, when in fact, as surely as night follows day, they'll just be gamed by the major players. So there you have it, folks. There's the overview of what really happened. So if you like and appreciate the old Tom Woods show, then become a supporting listener, because man, do you get a lot of bonuses for that, including membership in the great Tom Woods Show Elite, which is going to keep you sane during insane times. So warm my heart by heading over to supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.